For those of you who are new enough not to know, I do two or three sermons a year under the title of Potpourri or Salmagundi or Omnium Gatherum or Odds and Ends. It's a way of saying that the sermon is a grab bag of miscellaneous stuff which I don't care to make into a full-fledged sermon, but which I feel too strongly about to toss and forget without sharing. So here's the final potpourri sermon for 1993. And if you will engage me now briefly in a kind of mental dialogue, you will know which parts of this you wish to accept and which parts of it you cannot buy at all. It isn't entirely conventional. Item one. On Sunday morning, about 3 years ago, while Billy and I were waiting in Stanley, Idaho, for John and Kim Carraway to fly in from Boise for our float trip on the Salmon River, we walked over to the little community church in that tiny town to worship. It was a rustic building, but the entire wall behind the pulpit was glass, so that as we sat for the sermon, we could look past the preacher at the whole majestic sweep of the snow-covered Sawtooth Mountains. The visiting preacher meant well, but the mountains were more compelling than he was. And I wondered as I looked at them how differently one might think of God and religion who grew up in that country as opposed to someone who knew only what my Colorado son loves to call the flatlands. So how much is religion influenced by geography? Do people form some of their notions of God because of the landscape around them? Is it only a coincidence that three of the world's great religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, were born in the desert, where the heavens are so close and brilliant at night, and the silence and the loneliness encourage profound meditation? The ancient Greeks lived in the mountains and by the sea. They created a religion that exalted beauty, that was generally tolerant, and that featured gods and goddesses with all the flaws and failings of mortal men and women. But religions from the desert tend to reflect that world, austere, demanding, intolerant of mistakes. And because life in such a place is so hard, believers dream of an afterlife that will give them, in perfection and abundance, the things they never got quite enough of. Lacking plenty of fresh, sweet water, they dreamed of a paradise, of clear rivers and lush gardens, bordered by fruit trees that never stopped bearing. I don't know how far one may push this notion of how landscape influences religion, but when it came to mind the other day, I pulled a book off the shelf to reread a chapter I had not looked at in years. A close friend who wrote it had grown up in Abilene, Texas. He called the chapter God in West Texas, claiming that since West Texas is arid, harsh, unforgiving, the religion of the true native tends to be much the same. In that country, he writes, the sun burns hard, it burns the color out of cloth and paint, it burns the moisture from the soil, it burns the sin out of people, because sin is a moist, soft thing, tinted pretty colors. West Texas is like the biblical lands, a hot, dry desert country with low blue hills along its horizon, which are nothing but rocks when you reach them. Perhaps it is this kinship with the land of the Bible which causes it to hold to the fundamentalist religions, to cling to dry, feverish beliefs which demand more of people than they are capable of offering, even to God, beliefs which promise nothing on earth but sweat, frustration, and retribution for error. God still comes down and watches what people do in West Texas. He goes to the plain cream brick churches on Sunday mornings, and he is back for evening worship and Wednesday night prayer meeting, making note of who is not faithful in attendance. Some of you would be in trouble. Stay in Kansas. Who remains steadfast to the doctrine, and who has faltered. This God of an unforgiving landscape, my friend writes, chastises those who think they know too much, who refuse to accept their lives as His will. Nothing can change that, for there the sun is, His eye, and it is so brassy it seems to be a mirror following you with a blinding shaft no matter which way you turn. Now, how much of that is true and how much is poetic license may be debatable, but I do know this. Any careful student of the Bible recognizes that the imagery of its prose and poetry and the representation of God as shepherd or Near Eastern monarch certainly seems to have been influenced by the culture in which the Bible was written. It doesn't take much imagination to understand why a God and a religion from a Polynesian culture, where life is easier, might be very, very different. Why say anything about this? Because it is one more aid in reading the Bible intelligently. Item 2. The Apostle Paul writes to his little Christian church in Galatia that Christ set us free to be free people. And that must have had a glorious ring to their ears. But he adds a cautionary footnote. Just make sure you do not turn your freedom into license. I've thought a lot about that footnote in the past few weeks. In what we call, in song, the land of the free, hardly anything is held to be more precious than freedom. But as the great apostle and philosophers all over the world remind us, hardly anything can be more dangerous when freedom is turned into license to do anything one wants to do. I want us to think about the responsibilities of freedom this morning, because here we are in church, taking seriously the word of someone who said, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free," And how can that mean much unless we consider occasionally just what it means to be free? Does it mean that we have all these inviolable rights and no one dares infringe on them? I heard on radio last week that tuberculosis has nearly doubled in Sedgwick County since last year. County health officials say that those with this infectious disease, spread by air through coughing and sneezing, should be very sure to continue their medicine. Some victims have refused, saying, "It's my business whether I take the medicine or not. I have rights. Don't intrude on my liberty." In other words, don't tell me what I must do to keep from infecting friends and neighbors. Minor problem, but it does raise the issue, how far does personal freedom extend for irresponsible people who endanger the health of all of us? Last week, I read that the National Federation of State High Schools has banned those deeply sagging shorts that you've seen on some basketball courts. Now, the issue is not public health, but what the Federation sees as an offense against good taste and as a kind of general sloppiness and lack of discipline that demeans the sport. I have no interest, really, in whether the Federation is right or wise to call for a dress code. What irritates me is that some players' responses are so predictable. Why should they tell us what to do? How dare they infringe upon our personal rights? It's the old question of freedom versus discipline imposed by oneself or by others, of personal rights over against the rules of an organization under whose auspices one works or plays. It seems at times we have kidded ourselves into thinking freedom can be absolute, when the truth is that society and all its benefits are impossible unless individual freedom on occasions is limited. Then I watch a curious and fascinating documentary about what was called the cleanest city in the world. I hope some of you saw it. I like clean so much that caught my attention right away. I remember the shock and embarrassment I felt when I came back after 2 years in England and really noticed for the first time how we disfigure the beauty of town and country with advertising signs, billboards, large and small, thousands and thousands of them. I wanted to be back home. I had no wish to live somewhere else. But I knew that someday we would get rid of all that clutter, and I was sorry to think that it would not happen in my lifetime. 3 years ago, coming home from the order and cleanliness of Switzerland and of airports in places like Zurich and Munich, I was appalled at the squalor and filth at JFK in New York City. What a greeting, I thought, for people who come to see us for the first time. So when I see this teaser on television about the cleanest city in the world, I drop everything to watch. The city, as some of you already know, is Singapore, where there is no littering, no spitting on the sidewalk, No urinating in elevators. No graffiti on walls. The place fairly sparkles. But all this good stuff isn't voluntary. People in Singapore are not by nature just better people than we are. They don't mess up their city because they are not allowed to mess it up. There are fines so stiff and so rigorously enforced that people learn very quickly to restrain themselves. Unfortunately, there are some other restraints I would not like, and calling the place a police state may be accurate, but I kept wondering, is there no middle ground? Do we grant so much personal freedom that we endanger public health, offend normal standards of decency, turn public parks and sidewalks into piles of trash? Where and how often does the exercise of personal liberty threaten to spoil life for others? And what do we do about it? Then I read last week, forced this sermon, actually, I read in the same newspaper that several states, California, Connecticut, Hawaii, Iowa, New York, Texas, for example, have made their seatbelt laws primary, which means that police can stop you for no other reason than that you are not wearing one. Now, it's not just that those states have kind-hearted legislators eager to keep people safe. It's also, and probably mainly, because they need to save the millions of dollars being spent on extended hospital and therapy care for accident victims who would have been all right if they had worn their seatbelts. Seatbelt use, because of such laws, was up significantly in 1993, and the statisticians say that that translates into 500 lives saved. That is no trivial figure in itself, but think beyond it to the suffering, disfigurement, and crippling of thousands more who didn't die in the wrecks, but often wish they had. How far can society go to protect itself from the careless, mandating seat belts, mandating helmets, taking you out of the driving business when you claim the freedom to be irresponsible and drink too much? Well, there's no easy answer to any of this, especially for someone who cares as deeply as I do about personal freedom. You are listening, after all, to a man who believes in the freedom of hopelessly ill and horribly suffering people to make an exit from life in as convenient and dignified a way as possible. Contrary to popular belief, there is not a law against suicide anywhere in our sacred scripture. And I do not mind telling you that under the worst of circumstances, I would thank God for a doctor willing to help me. We all know by now that the greatest single danger to human life is the uncontrolled population explosion around the world. But woe to any society that tries seriously to limit reproductive rights. We were horrified to read that some country insists on one child per family. We ought to be equally horrified when parents who cannot possibly care for the children they bring into the world choose in their freedom to have 10 of them. You may have read just last week that China's Minister of Public Health wants to halt the birth of children known to be diseased and deformed on the grounds that China now has 10 million such children to care for. The easy response, the likely response, of course, is to say how heartless these people are. But it may rather be that China weighs the public above the private good and feels it will collapse into chaos if the burden of caring for severely handicapped persons becomes impossible for the state. If the AIDS epidemic continues to spread through all sections of society, as it is predicted to do, how many mothers with that disease should be free to bear how many infected children at unbelievable cost to society? Some of you, ladies and gentlemen, will have to wrestle with such questions, and they are as much a part of your religious profession as this genteel worship time on Sunday. Now, maybe it was just that it was on my mind, but last week seemed to have a new example every day of freedom abused. You must have been appalled at the red-hot sales of Charlie Manson t-shirts, hats, dresses, jackets, even children's wear, under the name of a sadist whose followers killed 7 people, including a beautiful young actress who begged them to spare the life of her unborn child while they stabbed her to death. Teenagers with no knowledge of that horrible night 25 years ago see Charles Manson as only a rebel against society. And they say things like, well, they let out people who've done worse things than he has. Question about these Manson songs and sales. Does the clever entrepreneur turn liberty into license when it's excused, when the grisly violence that's being celebrated is excused as just a counterculture protest? Should Charles Manson, in the name of personal freedom, receive money from any of this new adventure in free enterprise? So I'm not preaching on the parables or Jonah and the whale, but there are Christian legislators in this room, and there are Christian voters in this room, and they are accountable for some measure of thoughtfulness as they address such problems. I do not believe in simplistic answers from pulpits to complex issues, but I do believe in the Paul principle. You must not let your freedom become license. I believe that freedom demands responsibility, and that when we do not act responsibly, society may reach so desperate a point that it will impose the restraints we were not willing to impose upon ourselves. The debate has gone on forever, but with more and more people in less and less space, it is reaching a flashpoint. Should I have the right to own an assault weapon? How shall the city council decide about the rights of those who smoke as against the rights of those who don't? Is there an intelligent Christian response to such questions? All I ask this morning is that in the words of our own sacred writings, we think on these things.